Join me for today's reading. This is the account of Jacob's family line. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and he brought their father a bad report about them. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons, because he had loved them and had been born to him in his old age. He made an ornate robe for him. When his brothers saw that their fathers loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright, while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it." His brother said to him, "Do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us?" And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. The word of God for the people of God. Please be seated.
We are continuing our sermon series on story, Living a Life Worth Telling. It's based on a book by Donald Miller called A Million Miles in a Thousand Years. And I remember the very first week Nick was up here and he was introducing this series. He asked the question, if your life was a movie, would anybody want to watch it? And I remember pondering that question and thinking, I'm not so sure I would want my life to be like the movies I like to watch. Any James Bond fans out there, right? Okay. James Bond series has been around for about 50 years, and I've been around for about 50 years. And James Bond has been shot at a total of 4,662 times. And in my 50 years, I have been shot at a total of 0 times. And I like my way better. Also, even thinking about my favorite movie of all time, I'm going to go old school on you a little here. I would not want to have to go through the things the main character goes through. My favorite movie of all time is the 1984 baseball classic, The Natural, starring Robert Redford. I don't know if you're familiar with the story or not. Now, if you also remember, Nick told us what makes a story great is when a character wants something and has to overcome conflict to get it. And if you're familiar with The Natural, it's based on a novel by the same name, but in the movie, there is a young baseball player named Roy Hobbs, and what he wants more than anything in life is to be the greatest baseball player that ever played the game. He wants to be able to walk down the street, and everybody goes, "There goes Roy Hobbs, the greatest there ever was." And at age 19, he is on the verge of his dream of playing in the major leagues. He has gotten a call to report to a training camp for the Chicago Cubs, which means it's almost the major leagues here. It's almost the major leagues, okay? But on his way, he encounters this woman. She's a serial killer who is stalking and killing famous athletes, and she shoots him. So see, once again, I'm trying to avoid people shooting at me, so I really don't want to go through what Roy Hobbs had to go through. The shooting sidetracks his career, and you pick up 16 years later where at age 35, he's trying to make the majors, at this time as a hitter rather than a pitcher. Now, what I like about this movie, it's a movie woven throughout the whole entire story. You see good versus evil. You see lightness versus darkness. And it just shows throughout the movie. And of course, because movies have to be concise, they only have 120 minutes to tell the story roughly. Every scene, every bit of action, every decision always leads you to the ending, so that the ending will turn out like you know it turns out because of all that happened. And wouldn't it be nice if life was that way, that every decision we made we know would have some important influence on what happens long term? But let's be honest. We make decisions every day, and most of them really aren't that important as far as how our life ends, okay? For example, you get up one morning and you decide you want coffee and donuts, and you've got a couple of options. You can go to Dunkin' Donuts or you can go to Krispy Kreme's. Does it matter which establishment you go to? Some say yes. I don't do coffee. But for most of us, we would say that may not be that important of a decision. But suppose a single man makes that decision. He goes to one establishment and there's a cute girl behind the counter. She waits on him. She smiles at him. They begin a conversation. They start dating. They end up getting married. Or suppose you're in there and you encounter a person who's just moved to Lexington to start a new business, and he's looking for employees and meets your skill set. And you start talking, you get a job, it changes your career, changes your whole life. What seemed like, at least to most of us, an insignificant decision of where you go to have donuts and coffee can all of a sudden be a life-changing event. And wouldn't it be nice if in life we knew that those decisions that we're making that would have lasting consequences, we knew that at the time we're making them. But unlike movies and books, we don't have the benefit of knowing where the story's going to end. And so we make those decisions, and sometimes they're important and sometimes they're not. We just don't know at the time we're making them. But there is one commonality that we all have when we make decisions. All of us believe down deep in our hearts that when we make good, wise, godly decisions, there ought to be good results. And when we make poor, foolish, ungodly decisions, there ought to be bad results. We know that's the way things ought to be, but as so often in life, we don't know where the decisions are going to lead. Sometimes we make good decisions and bad things happen, and sometimes we make bad decisions and good things happen. Now, last week, Pastor Jeff, in his sermon, talked about an element of the story called inciting incidents. An inciting incident is a point in a story where the main character is faced with a decision or faced with a circumstance where they have to act. They make a decision to act in regard to this incident that's happened to them. And almost always, that's the crux of the story. How the character decides, whatever they choose, goes on to show us how the story plays out down the line. And once again, it ought to be if you make good decisions, good things happen, and bad decisions, bad things happen. But that's not always how life works out. And that's certainly not true as we look at a biblical character named Joseph. For those of you who are familiar with this story, we're going to work real quickly through his life. For those of you who aren't familiar, start reading in Genesis, the first book of the Bible, chapter 37, and read for about 11 chapters. But we're going to look at four inciting incidences in his life and see the decisions he made and what resulted from those decisions. And the first one we heard about is Rod read the scripture up here. And that was, he had a godly vision. It came to him in the form of a dream. And Joseph had the ability to interpret and understand dreams. Now, as he has this dream, you have to understand that Joseph is his father's favorite son. And all of his brothers know he is his father's favorite son, and they resent him for that. So they already don't like him. And then he has this inciting incident of a godly vision. And in the dream, he and his brothers are out harvesting the fields, and he has a sheath of grain, and they have sheath of grain. But his stands firm, and theirs bow down to him. And then he has a dream about the stars and the moon bowing down to him. Now, he knows what this dream means. In the future, at some point in time, his family is going to bow before him. His brothers are going to bow down to him. And here's where he makes what I consider a poor decision. He knows this is going to happen, but he decides to tell his brothers. Why? Because he wants to lift himself up. He wants to show them that he's better than them, and he wants them to know it. So he tells his brothers about the dream. Well, his brothers, who are already jealous of him, pretty much figure, this is it. We're done with this guy. So they overpower Joseph. They throw him in a cistern. And then when a caravan comes by, they sell him into slavery. The caravan was on its way to Egypt. He eventually ends up as a servant in one of the officials' households in Egypt. The official's name is Potiphar. So he makes a bad decision, bad thing happens. It is when he is in Potiphar's house that his second inciting incident happens. Now realize he is a capable, competent young man. So he rises within the ranks of Potiphar's servants where he's pretty much put over the entire household. He's capable, he's competent, and Potiphar's wife thinks he's handsome as well. So she makes a play for him. And the incident is he has an ungodly advance, which is followed by an accusation. The ungodly advance comes from Potiphar's wife who wants to go to bed with him. But this time his decision is to do the right thing. And he decides to lift up God's standard. And God's standard says you don't go to bed with your master's wife. When she's rejected, she then makes an accusation against him, claiming he was the one that had pursued her. She calls the household guards, and the result of him doing the right thing here is he's thrown into prison. And in prison, just like he did as a servant, he kind of rises to the top. The warden likes him. He gets along with the other prisoners. In fact, he's shown to be capable and competent, and he rises to where he's really over all the other prisoners. And then we have a third inciting incident. And that is in the form of two godly visions that occur to two different prisoners. One of them is a cupbearer to Pharaoh who's been thrown in prison. And he has a dream. The other is a baker who is in Pharaoh's kitchen and he has a dream. And they both come to Joseph and they tell them about their dreams. And because he has the ability to interpret dreams, Joseph knows where the dreams are going to lead. But here's where he has to make a decision, and it's not as easy as you might think. His decision is to lift up God's truth about the dreams, and that may seem easy. And for the cupbearer, it's easy to tell him because he says, in 3 days, you're going to be freed from prison and you're going to be restored to your former position. For the baker, it's not such good news. In 3 days, he's going to lose his life. Now, Joseph could have just said to the cupbearer, here's the good news, and to the other guy, well, I'm not going to really tell you what your dream means. But he decided to lift up the truth and the whole truth. That's his decision. He tells the cupbearer, would you do me a favor? When you get back to your former position and you're before Pharaoh, would you tell him my story? Would you tell him that I was falsely accused? I've been falsely imprisoned. Would you tell him to release me? And the cupbearer says, I got you covered. But the bottom line is the cupbearer didn't tell Pharaoh about him. The result, even though Joseph did the right thing, was he was forgotten. And he remains in prison for 2 more years. In 2 years, we have the fourth inciting incident. And this time it is also in the form of a godly vision in a dream that occurs to Pharaoh. Pharaoh has this dream. And in this dream, there are 7 healthy stalks of grain that get swallowed up by 7 unhealthy stalks of grain. There are 7 healthy, fat, plump cows that get eaten by 7 sickly, thin cows. And Pharaoh wants to understand what the dream means. And so he asks all his advisors, and no one knows. And then all of a sudden, the cupbearer says, oh, by the way, there was this guy named Joseph in prison, and he could interpret dreams. And so they call Joseph, and Joseph, because God has given him the ability to understand dreams, knows exactly what the dreams mean. And his decision, once again, is not as easy as it might seem. His decision is to tell about God's plan for the future. And the first 7 years of that plan are good. For the 7 healthy stalks of grain, the 7 fat cows represent that Egypt will experience 7 years of abundance. The crops will be plentiful. They'll have more to eat than they can imagine. But following that, here's the bad news. The bad news is the 7 skinny cows, the 7 sickly stalks of grain, represent 7 years of famine that will be so severe that they will forget about the previous 7 years. And Pharaoh says, what should we do? And Joseph says, well, the best plan would be during those 7 plentiful years to save up as much food as we can, and we just might be able to survive those 7 years of famine. And so the result, once again, of making a good godly decision here, this time he's lifted up. Pharaoh lifts him up and places him in charge of all the resources in Egypt. He is put in a position to make a difference, and a difference he does make. For he saves so much food in those 7 years. Not only does Egypt survive the 7 years of famine, but they are able to sell food to other nations and people. And who would some of those people be? It would be his very brothers who come looking for food. And in order to get food, they bow down to Joseph, just as his original dream had predicted. And as we look at Joseph's story, you know, the first and the last incident and decision makes sense, right? The first one, he makes a bad decision, he gets sold into slavery. The last one, he makes a good decision, he gets lifted up. That makes sense to us because we think things ought to be fair, but it's those middle two that causes problems. Because he did what was right, and he was thrown in prison, and he was forgotten. And let's be honest, we don't like it when things don't work out like they're supposed to. We like happy endings. Even in stories where the hero experiences conflict, in the end, we want happy endings, right? I mean, the movie The Natural, it ends with Roy Hobbs hitting a three-run homer and his team wins the pennant. But as I told you, the movie is based on a novel. And in the novel, the author, Bernard Malamud, actually has Roy Hobbs striking out. And he walks down the street, and rather than people say, "There goes the greatest that ever played the game," nobody recognizes him. They had to change the ending for the movie. Why? Because there's no way we're paying money to go see Roy Hobbs strike out. Right? Because that's not what we want. We want happy endings. But Donald Miller, in his book that's the basis for this series, makes this statement. He says, there is no happily ever after in real life. And what he means by that is not that there's not happiness in life, but he says, after we overcome an obstacle and experience a victory, life just doesn't stop there. Life continues. And guess what? Just as we overcame some positive and negative situations in our life to get where we're at today, in the future, days to come, there's going to be more positive and negative turns. There's going to be more obstacles to overcome, and I hope more victories as well. This week, a person was sharing with me that she had some girlfriends and they got married, and they made the comment that after they got married, they expected it to be like a fairy tale. Yeah, everybody who's been married more than like 5 weeks knows exactly what I'm talking about, right? Why isn't it like a fairy tale? Because you didn't marry a prince and he didn't marry a princess. But we expect things to be that way, and as Christians, we're probably even more susceptible. Why? Because we've all heard it. Well, the Christian life is all about joy and happiness and peace and contentment. And when we don't experience those things, when we have conflict in our life, we think, what's wrong with us? And that's hard. And there are some authors, there are some people who think, well, if you're not experiencing victory at every aspect of your life, something must be wrong with you. A while back, I read a book by a popular Christian author, and he insinuated that if you aren't experiencing victory in your life, it's simply because you're not praying big enough, bold enough prayers. Now, don't get me wrong. I believe in praying big prayers. And I believe that people who pray do better than people who don't. And churches that pray do better than churches that don't. And when we start praying for our community, it's amazing the transformation that takes place. I believe in big, bold prayers. But the problem is, this author had taken something that is generally true and they had made an absolute truth out of it, saying, well, if you're not having victory in your life, it's on you. You just need to pray bigger, bolder prayers. And I'll tell you why I had problems with this book. Because while I'm reading this book, at the same time, I'm working my way through a biography of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Okay, you probably don't know who Dietrich Bonhoeffer is. I admit, I'm a theological geek, okay? My opinion, Dietrich Bonhoeffer is the greatest theologian of the 20th century. He was born around the turn of the century in Germany, brilliant theological mind. But what I love about Bonhoeffer is he wasn't just an ivory tower theologian. he really tried to live out the faith. In fact, as he was working his way through theological school and working on his doctorate and all that, they actually put him in charge of a group of seminary students and say, we want you to teach them. And rather than just teaching them about the scriptures and teaching them about, you know, theology through the ages, he said, I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to live in community together. We're going to live together with one simple rule. And that rule is, as we live together in community, we're going to try to understand what it means to live out the Sermon on the Mount. You see, it's not just about learning theology with your head. It's about living it out in your life. As the Nazis rose to power, Bonhoeffer joined a resistance movement called the Confessing Church that was opposing all that the Nazis were doing. Bonhoeffer at that time had traveled over to America, and he knew as things began to get dangerous over in Germany for those who opposed Hitler, he knew he could be safe if he stayed in America. But he decided that if I expect the church in Germany to fight evil, I can't do it unless I'm willing to go and join them. And so he left the safety of America and went over to his homeland to fight evil. In 1943, because of his resistance to the Nazis, he was arrested, put in prison. Now, much like Joseph, the warden loved him. The guards loved him. The prisoners loved him. And he kind of rose up to this position where he could walk around the prison. He could meet with other prisoners and minister to them. He could write letters that they would have come in and out. He was pretty much allowed to do whatever he wanted to do for about a year. But then there was a plot on Hitler's life, and Bonhoeffer was linked to the conspirators. So he was then transferred from that prison to a higher security prison, and then he ended up in one concentration camp and finally landed at a concentration camp in Flossburg. Now, I believe, because he had incredibly faithful parents, that all this time he was in prison, they were praying big, bold prayers for him. And I believe his fiancée, who was a godly woman, was also praying big, bold prayers for her future husband. And we know the Hollywood story, right? The Allies are approaching in 1945, and they're approaching the concentration camp in Flossenbürg. And they get there, and they liberate the camp and free all the prisoners. And that's exactly what happened 2 weeks too late to save Bonhoeffer. Now, why would I tell that story? I mean, come on, we don't pay money to see Roy Hobbs strike out, and we don't come to church to hear pastors tell stories that end in death. I tell that story because I don't think Bonhoeffer's life story ends in death, because I think he understood a truth about inciting incidents, positives and negatives turns, and he learned a lesson that we can learn when we look at the life of Joseph and when we look at the life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And the first of those lessons that we learn is godly decisions are more important than worldly success. Think if Bonhoeffer had stayed in America, he would have been safe. We would have had how many more theological books that we could have read from this brilliant theologian. He probably would have become one of the best-selling theologians of all time. He could have walked down the street and people would have said, there goes the greatest theologian that ever was. But he knew if his faith really meant anything, it wasn't just about staying where it's safe. It's about doing the right thing and going and fighting evil, even amongst the danger. So he did the right thing despite the cost. I often think of Joseph too. You know, as Joseph was making those decisions, he didn't know where they would end. But think about that. What if the cupbearer had never mentioned his name? What if instead of staying in prison for 2 extra years, he stayed there for the rest of his life and Egypt wouldn't have been saved and we never would have known about Joseph? But still, doing the right thing is the right thing regardless of the worldly consequences or worldly success. Lesson number one is we've got to make godly decisions and not worry about worldly success. Now, as I said, I don't think Bonhoeffer's story ends in death. On his last Sunday on earth, Bonhoeffer was leading a worship service in that concentration camp. And after they finished the worship service, the guards came to take him away. And he knew where he was going. He knew what was going to happen. And he leans over to a fellow inmate and he says, "This is the end for me, the beginning of life." Bonhoeffer realized a second lesson, and that was, it was the end, but it was just the beginning. Why? Because it wasn't about Bonhoeffer's story. It was about God's story. And we need to realize the same thing. So often in life, we say, "God, here's my story. Here's what I want. Here's the obstacles in my way. And if you would just come in and bless my life, if you would just come in and make things a little easier for me, I give you permission to do that." But the reality is, it's not about our stories. If we're going to live a life that's worth living, it comes not when we invite God into our story, but when we accept the invitation into his story. By all worldly accounts, Jesus' story didn't end well either. I mean, he was betrayed, denied, arrested, beaten, spit upon, sentenced, and crucified. But that wasn't the end. It was only the beginning. Because on the third day, he rose from the grave. And his victory over death gives us power over death as well when we accept his invitation into his story. When we become participants with him, not just in his death, but more importantly, in his resurrection. And that's exactly where Jesus is inviting you today. If you haven't accepted him, I encourage you to do so. Join his story. Join with him. Become a participant with him in this journey called life. And he's going to show you new life and resurrection. And as we as a church gather this morning to celebrate the Lord's Supper, once again, he's inviting us to the table to come and partake of his body and his blood, the bread and the cup, so that we can become participants, so we can become one with him, commune with him by inviting him into our lives. John Wesley said this about communion: Christ is always present, but he is especially present in the sacraments. I don't invite you to the table today. Jesus invites you to the table today. As those helpers who are going to help come forward, we're going to prepare to receive this sacrament, to say yes to the invitation of Jesus Christ, to commune in fellowship with him.